we're going to move the affordable housing slash TOD success stories, starring Bill topic, to after the break. So after John does his certification dance, is that a 2 or 3 step dance? Probably a 42 step dance, huh? We'll take the break and then we'll come back and hear from Bill, Dave, and Patrick. Okay? Follow that? All right. So with that, what I'm going to do is introduce Paul McDougall, who's going to talk about a prescription for pain-free housing element certification. And again, you've got his bio there, but as I indicated earlier, I've done a whole, I almost want to say too many housing elements, but I've done a number of housing elements. In a few of those cases, and I use this term explicitly, I've had the pleasure of working with Paul through that certification process. And I've always found him to be just a terrific resource and asset through referring me to a number of websites or data sources or solutions or referring me to other jurisdictions that have done, in his mind, model parts of the housing element. And he's always open to approaching the problems from a non-traditional approach. I mean, the example that just recently came to mind is in San Juan Capistrano, where we're having trouble with density stuff, and we came up with this density gap financing approach. And Paul was very, I thought, now I'm going to have to go to HED. And he was really receptive to it, and it helped get us through that process. And so he's going to share some comments with you, and I think you're going to enjoy his perspective. Mr. McDougall.
So I have to use the mic?
You absolutely have to use the mic. The mic, not mic.
Well, thank you, everybody. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's been a long time since I've come down to San Diego. For a while there, we were down here on a very regular basis, visiting your jurisdictions, a lot of familiar faces out there. And it used to be one of my favorite bus rides going from the airport down to downtown San Diego. It's absolutely beautiful, beautiful region. I'm really, really pleased to be here today. So as Mike said, I'm Paul McDougall. My main role is with the Housing Policy Development Division of the State Department of Housing and Community Development. And a lot of what I do is working with the review of housing elements. And I just wanted to give you a sense of where we are in terms of our review of the housing elements statewide. As Susan mentioned earlier, there's been sort of a, with the alignment of regional transportation planning, we're seeing more reviews in a shorter time frame. And we have seen most of the state, and particularly out of the Bay Area in Southern California, so roughly 300 plus jurisdictions over the last couple of years. And as of right now, we're at about 270 jurisdictions that have actually adopted. And of those that are adopted, I would say roughly 90% are in compliance. And so what that says is that for those that are in for doing the review process, for submitting the draft, for getting our findings and addressing those findings, compliance is right around the corner. So that's always something to keep in mind. And I think that as far as the compliance rate in the region last time, we're also, at least of those that adopted, at a fairly high rate. Today, would you title it again? Can I change it? What's my workshop title?
I know this will be
use the mic now.
I knew there was a downside letting you have the mic. I enjoyed it much more when you were sitting down there and you could go Padres. For a Bay Area person, that's going to be hard for you to deal with, but cause suck up.
Mark Hoffman told me to say Giants.
Yeah, I put it in there. Yeah.
But either way, I don't know if I would say pain-free or what'd you say? What's it say on there?
Prescription.
That's what that means. RX. All those acronyms. My goodness, planners. But prescription for pain-free housing. A prescription would be no prescription. That'd be my response to that. There's no need for a prescription. But what I would like to do today is to kind of give an overview of infill in the housing element, and also an overview. We'll dig into the adequate size requirement and pull up some of those more prominent areas that we'll see in the era of SB 375 and so forth, and just really make sure to clearly explain what that statute is, what it requires, as well as, you know, some hints or some things to consider to help you address those requirements. So with that, I'll go to the next slide. And so this is just an overview. So I'll just kind of go over the housing 375 adequate sites requirement, but I'll also touch on SB 375 changes to the housing element. So Susan talked a lot about today the changes to the regional housing need allocation process of the housing element law, but there's also some changes to the housing element, and I'll go into just a little bit more detail on that. And I also, because folks are going to be updating, want to just mention a few of the requirements, a few of the changes to the statute since I had the opportunity to see y'all last. So just three primary ones there. So we hear with 375 and infill and so forth, and infill in the housing element, it isn't a new thing. There's a long history of housing elements through our reviews, through the requirements of establishing strategies to promote infill, to target sites on non-vacant sites through the provisions such as a variety of housing types or zoning to accommodate our needs. We've seen rezoning within our boundaries, within existing areas on a very, for a long time now. So this isn't something that's groundbreaking. It's not new. It's something that we've seen for a long time. And just to give you a sense of what's been happening since 2007 in terms of rezoning, we've seen, based on preliminary data, we've seen about 3,100 acres since 2007 rezoned to higher densities, minimum densities, probably with a capacity of about 70,000 units, and also that's just within the adopted jurisdictions. So it's about 70 jurisdictions out of about 250 that are rezoning as part of the housing element update process. And one thing that was always key last time in San Diego was you had your smart growth opportunity areas, but there's also sort of two types of smart growth opportunity areas: those with existing zoning that meet the criteria, and those with the potential. And one thing that really over time, and I could think of a handful of places, through the housing element review process, these areas with potential were being rezoned, and that capacity was being added. And this is something that we went through last time, so these aren't things that are new. But what we do see as far as the SB 375 is that it highlights and it recognizes the importance of housing planning in the broader scope of land use and linkages to transportation. And particularly, it also highlights the importance of the housing element in terms of timely adoption or update, timely implementation. You're gonna see consequences for that stuff. And also, there's some changes in terms of our programs, the specific actions and deadlines. Those must have an impact in the planning period. So you can see through SB 375 that there are some recognition of the importance of the housing element. And one point, sort of hearing tones and what have you about certain areas that I heard the term gap at one point, or disconnect between the reviews and redevelopment and what have you. But it's important to remember that these analyses that are required for redevelopable areas, that are required for capacity for mixed use or the types of sites that you have or what have you, it's important to go through that process to ensure that the sites that are being identified are the most realistic opportunities. We can't address our housing needs in these areas unless we're identifying the most realistic opportunities, and we cannot achieve the objectives of SB 375 and all the broader planning objectives unless we have realistic opportunities. And one thing that is also key to this is that, you know, once we have our sites, once we have our programs in place, that we must implement those things. You know, it's the responsibility of the jurisdictions to plan and to implement, to encourage redevelopment, to set things in place, to set the table so these things actually can occur and we can achieve our objectives and be successful as a region, as well as state. So I'm just gonna kinda go, this is just a broad overview of the adequate sites requirement. I mean, are folks familiar enough with this, or? If not, I'm obligated to say it anyways, so. But as far as the adequate sites requirement, there's four major components. The first component is your regional housing need allocation. That's your projected need. And I was excited to hear that you guys say RENA like we do up in Sacramento, because other places say RANA and RINA. I'm glad you don't say that. So first you have your projected needs. Susan talked about it. That's by income groups and what have you. And then that really catalyzes the rest of the adequate sites requirement. Where first, and this is a new requirement that you met last time, is a parcel listing. This is a listing for each, you know, based on either parcel number or unique reference, listing of each parcel by their size, by their general plan designation, by their zone, and by their actual calculation of capacity on those sites. Once you have that parcel listing, then there needs to be analysis to demonstrate that those lists, you know, at least sufficient to accommodate the RENA, analysis of their suitability, their availability. So these are things like environmental constraints, known conditions that wouldn't allow their development in the planning period, the size of the sites, and then whether they can accommodate typical affordable developments and so forth. So that's the analysis piece, first the analysis piece. The second part of the analysis piece is the relationship of zoning to the sites and facilities and so forth. So those means things like whether zoning encourages and facilitates the development of housing for low-income households. That's the density proxy that Susan was talking about earlier, the 30 units per acre for most of you, unless you're, Del Mar, Solana Beach. Other pieces of that last part of the analysis is things like infrastructure. You have total capacity, and as well as proximity to services. And you're seeing more and more in inventories, and this is something maybe to think about as a region as well, because there's some discussion of our progress in terms of units produced by income group, is when you're doing analysis of proximity to services amenities, we've seen more and more in the inventories that you're actually seeing proximity to things like parks, to things like schools, to things like transit. And those types of characteristics really line up with financing mechanisms. They make you more competitive. For example, for tax credits, if you're closer to transit, if you're closer to parks, if you're closer to schools. And so you're seeing more and more local governments trying to identify those really primary opportunities so you can target resources and be more effective in your implementation and addressing your needs. Today, in this era of 375, we recognize that there will be a lot of attention on probably these three areas of the analysis. The non-vacant, the realistic capacity, particularly for mixed use, and small sites. And so what I'll do is I'll go through each one of these requirements and hopefully give some helpful hints and maybe a few examples, and we'll go from there. So non-vacant sites. It's important to recognize that redevelop or to have infill development, that we must demonstrate realistic opportunities on non-vacant sites. It's very important that these sites are available and can be redeveloped in the planning period. And so as far as the non-vacant analysis, the first piece is that parcel listing. The parcel listing, when you're doing parcel number, acreage, capacity, it should also describe the existing use. and should describe the existing use sufficiently to demonstrate its potential for redevelopment. So for example, there's a difference between saying something is residential or something that is maybe residential on an underutilized site or just saying commercial site to saying commercial and the use that is abandoned or for lease. You know, so it's important to describe things sufficiently to demonstrate their potential for redevelopment. Also, as part of that analysis, there's three factors for one, market conditions, two, development trends, and then finally, one more important ones, the extent the existing uses impede development in the planning period. And so you'll see, as far as to hit that last piece, some hints to demonstrate the extent, you know, in other words, what is the potential for redevelopment? Are the sites right? So as far as the analysis of extent, existing uses impede development, some of the things to consider are things like age and condition, things like, you know, is the use expiring, is it transitioning, is it marginal, is it operating? Also the degree of underutilization. So for us that means, you know, to what extent is the existing use, you know, compared to the buildable envelope. So let's say it's built out at 10% of allowable capacity. That's a very important factor. Also, if there is a interest from the property owner, if there's actually been projects proposed in the past or interest from a developer, those are very key points to lay out to show that there is clearly potential for redevelopment because there's an interest in moving forward. And one thing to think about is that oftentimes in elements we'll see a track record. So folks will say, look, there has been development on redevelopment or non-vacant sites in the past. And that's fine, that's good, that's very useful information. However, it's important to draw a link between the development in the past and the sites that you have in your inventory. So in other words, where the redevelopment occurred in the past, if it has no similarity to what you're identifying for the future, it's not very helpful. So when you're looking at those development trends of the past, it's important to draw that linkage to what you're anticipating, where you're anticipating your development in the future. And then finally, you know, the way the element is organized is there's different components, Mike went through them, but if you're really to break it down in two pieces, you know, on one end you have your analysis, this is looking at your past programs, housing needs, and so forth. And then you have your programs, your implementation actions. The sites inventory uses that same sort of framework. You know, you do analysis, and the idea is to learn from the analysis and to develop programs in response to that analysis. So depending on what you're coming up with in terms of your analysis of whether sites are ripe for redevelopment or you know, the extent existing uses impede and so forth, there should be programs in stride with that. If there's a strong reliance on redevelopable sites, then there should be strong programs to encourage their redevelopment. So think about that. And then some of the things in terms of those programs is as far as what local governments control. So things like zoning, things like incentives, modifying development standards, as well as tiering environmental review, those are all very useful things in terms of encouraging redevelopment. I wanted to, when we did the coordination panel, I promised some examples, but I didn't get them in the PowerPoint. But I know that there's a few consultants in the crowd here, and three, I think, good examples that could apply to the region. And I was thinking if those three could just give a quick, brief description. We have Veronica, who had an interesting experience in LA County and I think a very innovative use of resources, existing resources, to get the land inventory done. We have Genevieve in Redwood City, which had a variety of challenges, but yet a very, very good approach to non-vacant sites, as well as Mark Hoffman, who in El Monte. So where you actually, based on different factors like the things that I was talking about, established a ranking system of 1, 2, 3, 4, and listed those by each site to show, you know, what sites have the most redevelopment potential. So could you guys give us like just a quick 2 minute? Is that okay, Mike? He said okay. All right. Can we have the mic?
Yes.
Mike?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Let's go left and right, Veronica.
For the LA County Housing Element, I think we worked with Paul on that. And I think the way we did the sites inventory, given the fact that the county has to be responsible for about 67,000 units, so we did a GIS analysis initially together with AECOM. We did a GIS analysis to identify what are the potential sites based on the criteria that Paul has actually talked about, land to improvement ratio, age of construction and existing land uses, and also capacity, whether you're able to at least triple the density of the units on site, because if you tear one unit and build two units, that's not necessarily an efficient use in terms of redevelopment potential. So we screened down the site's inventory to all the infills potential. I think the innovative part of it that Paul did was we wanted to check the reality of it, but it's too massive. So we printed out all of those key sites that we thought we have, and we sent them out to all the code enforcement officers, and the code enforcement officers field checked all the sites for us. So I think that was a really interesting process and worked out really well. So.
Thank you.
Yes,
go ahead.
I'm Genevieve. I worked with Redwood City up in the Bay Area on their housing element, and a few of the fun things that they had going on up there was a really great regional kind of analysis that they have done that I can point people to if they're interested in some of that data up there. But as far as the sites inventory, we had a few extra oversights coming from nonprofit groups, and we were also updating the general plan at the same time. So we had to be sure that we were, you know, identifying the right sites to meet our land use plan with the new general plan, but also considering existing zoning based on what's on the ground now, which didn't necessarily reflect what we were planning for in the future. So a lot of what we did was basically go through Paul's list here, but we also were able to develop a bit of a narrative and an appendix to really kind of tell the story of those sites a little bit more, especially those sites that, you know, on the ground might not look like there would be much development potential, but in fact we had developers coming to the city to talk about those sites in the past. We were really able to tell the story of where that capacity really was based on the history of those sites, and that the breaking it down into a very clear table, I think, was also helpful. Itemizing each of those kind of listed categories of what is the age, what is the condition, what is a brief existing conditions report, but then also pulling in a little bit more narrative into the back to provide a little more context was helpful.
And another piece about that is also that that inventory and the way you present the information also showed the potential for consolidation. And the reason for consolidation was backed by the narration that you're talking about. Very good approach.
Okay, Paul. Thanks for putting me on the spot. My name's Mark Hoffman.
You got 2 minutes, by the way.
Okay. Well, we work with the city of El Monte in Los Angeles County, and it really is a built-out city that's undergone a lot of transformation, a lot of underutilized sites, a lot of existing uses that need to be replaced. And what we did for the housing element in terms of finding adequate sites is we looked at some redevelopment project areas, because those are the sites that have the most commitment from the city or potential redevelopment project area to actually have them turn over and be used for housing. And so what we did essentially was we took a look at two very underutilized corridors in the city. One had a redevelopment project area established, one was proposed for one. And we basically just went through the various categories that Paul had mentioned, looking at the parcel size and the capacity to consolidate with parcels right adjacent to them. We did a field survey, got out the camera, walked it, and looked at all the sites to see what was the condition of the property and the age of the structure. We also looked at the development interest on the site, whether there was a lease before a lease sign, whether it was vacant, abandoned, etc. And we also included a little bit of a kind of a simplified financial model to look at whether the site would pencil out if it would turn over, and simply rank the sites between 1 and 5. and we just went right down the list. It had to meet, you know, and there were certain things that absolutely had to meet. It had to meet a certain threshold for size, otherwise we tossed it out and said, you know what, it's not really feasible. Secondly, it had to be of a certain condition. But again, once you just go through that categorization and you rank a site between 1 through 5, it gives you a real good sense of where the most interest is. And what I thought was very interesting is that for a redevelopment agency, when you're looking at funding sites, you can actually start to see visually and graphically what are those sites that you should be putting your tax increment funds into. Oftentimes you'll look at one site and you say, you know what, this is actually what we should be doing. But when you pencil out and you look at all the alternatives and the criteria, it actually raises a few surprises. So if you only have $1 million or $2 million to spend, what are those key projects or key sites that you want to look at and use those as catalyst projects for the entire corridor? And so these were just some of the thoughts that I had.
Yeah, and we see as far as programs to encourage redevelopment, we see catalyst project kind of approach on a fairly regular basis. So thank you all, because I forgot to bring samples, sorry about that. But one thing I didn't touch on here is that also sometimes you might have some areas where there's aging or transitioning uses, and you can also provide some analysis based on those areas. So for example, Mark talked about maybe a commercial corridor with some aging, low intensity uses where they might be bringing in a larger or specific plan that allows more bulk or what have you. And so it's also good to have that analysis by area as well. Next, I want to touch on the realistic capacity requirement. There's two pieces to the realistic capacity requirement. One is, so I talked about the parcel listing. You have the acreage and the parcel number, zone, general plan, but also a calculation of capacity. That calculation of capacity, meaning the density assumptions or the capacity assumptions, there should be a methodology for that. There should be also analysis to support that methodology. So for example, if you're assuming 100% of maximum allowable densities, then there should be a pretty good analysis to demonstrate that, particularly given the requirement of accounting for land use and site improvements and so forth. On a fairly regular basis, we see people assume typically built densities. But the overall piece here is that whatever your calculation of capacity is, there should be a description of the methodology and support for that. The second piece is, and this is what we really want to get into for today, is there residential capacity assumptions on mixed use or non-residentially zoned sites? As far as looking at that, there's kind of two sub-pieces. All right, well, what's the extent of residential? Can you still get to that density? But also, what is the likelihood that residential work will occur there? So for example, just to really emphasize the point, let's say you've listed your whole inventory with commercial sites. That's a zone that's intended, that's designed for commercial uses, but maybe allows residential uses. Well, as far as the housing element, then it should discuss, well, what is the likelihood of residential development, or inversely, what is the likelihood that commercial uses will occur there? And your capacity assumptions should be consistent with that. Sometimes we'll see folks assuming 100% of their commercially zoned sites to be residential. All right, well, if that's the case, well, where's the support for that analysis? So it's very important, otherwise we're inflating our assumptions of capacity, but also importantly to consider is that there's another piece of the statute called no net loss law. So when you identify these sites by capacity, there's a requirement that you must maintain sufficient capacity to accommodate your arena throughout the planning period. And if something is gonna be approved less than what is being assumed, then there should be findings to make up for that lost capacity or rezone that additional capacity. So it's very important to be realistic about your capacity assumptions and realistic about the level that you're assuming residential on non-residentially zoned sites. And so a lot of when I talk about this, I think about the kind of the connection between the analysis and the programs. And some things to consider is, all right, well, let's say it's a mixed-use corridor, or farm-based, or whatever. The first thing is are 100% commercial or non-residential uses allowed? Simple question, mixed use. I would say most of the time, yes. If so, then what's the likelihood that that will occur? And our capacity assumptions should be consistent with that. Something else to think about is a lot of mixed use districts will have performance standards, a level of commercial that's required. Well, capacity assumptions should be consistent with that. But sometimes you'll even see that residential is required, which makes this analysis a lot easier. You require residential, or if you have programs to establish requirements for residential, then the need for this analysis kind of goes down because there's certainty for residential occurring on those sites. Some other things to think about is that another way to support the degree that residential is going to happen on mixed-use sites or going to happen on commercial sites is to look at actual development trends and apply those into the future. And one thing that I do want to touch on is a variety of programs that can help to promote that residential is occurring on those sites. So the first is that if you're assuming mixed-use sites that allow 100% non-residential uses, assuming those are going to be 100% residential, then the analysis should be in stride with that assumption. And just the opposite. If the assumption is, maybe 50% time, then the analysis again needs to be in stride with that. But also to have the programs in place in stride with those assumptions. So in other words, if you're assuming 100% residential and non-residential lease on sites, there should be programs in stride with that to promote that certainty for residential development. Things like minimum densities, things like establishing performance standards, and at the least having a program to actually, as part of your commitment within the Housing Element General Plan, to monitor those sites for the effectiveness in terms of residential development. So as far as this analysis, keep in mind, this part of the element, keep in mind the connection between the analysis and the programs to promote that certainty for residential development. And then next is small sites. So the statute requires a listing of the sites by size. It also requires an analysis of the suitability and availability of sites. It also requires analysis to show how each identified site can accommodate the RENA, particularly for low-income households. And so in terms of the inventory, something to consider is what a typical assisted federal state development its sizes. So in other words, we know through our state funding that a typical deal is going to be around 50 to 150 units. 150 units. It stretches, up to 200 and 300, stretches down to 20 and 30 in rural areas, maybe special needs, but just a typical range is 50 to 150 units. So when you're relying on sites that are, say, much smaller or much larger that don't really allow those developments, but yet you're assuming 100% of the site is going to be affordable low-income households, then there should be analysis to talk about the feasibility of that. And a lot of what we're seeing is that folks will look at the potential for consolidation. That they'll list sites individually, but they'll also list sites that could be aggregated, that have potential for consolidation and have capacity assumptions aggregated as well as individually. And another piece of the small sites is that there should be programs to encourage consolidation, to encourage development consistent is what you're assuming in the inventory. All right, so as far as SB 375 changes to the housing element, again, we see these changes that it stresses the importance and recognizes the importance of the housing element in actually achieving the goals and objectives of SB 375. And it does this through first the timely update, the timely implementation, as well as programs that have a beneficial impact. So Susan touched on it a little bit. One of the first changes is that Within, if elements aren't updated within 120 days of the statutory deadline, then you get to see us a little bit more often. That means from 8 years for 4 years, we like you, hopefully you like us, and you know, we'd be glad for that, but I'm guessing most folks might want to stay on the 8 years. And so you can tell that that requirement is clearly communicating that it's very important that we have our plans in place so we can implement them and so we can better achieve our goals and objectives. The second is rezoning. If your element is committing to rezoning in the planning period, that must be done within 3 years. Usually the statute, or previously the statute, was early enough to facilitate development in the planning period. But now it's an actual numerical standard, 3 years. And if it's not done after 3 years, you either need to make very specific findings of progress and other things, and still must be done within a year. And if it's not done after that, then essentially things can be approved on those candidate sites for rezoning, and as long as they meet health, safety, and development standards. So you talked about tensions between land use control, local land use control. So you can imagine in terms of the consequences of not doing the rezoning to address the needs, that it's kind of striking at the heart of that just a little bit. You know, but understand that there are very important consequences for not doing the rezoning in a timely manner. And the last specific change to the housing element for 375 is to the program. So now the program says that programs must have a beneficial impact in the planning period. So in other words, our programs can't explore the feasibility of a study for 5 years. Okay, our programs must have very specific things that will be done by certain dates to have an impact in the planning period. And that stresses the importance of not only planning, but planning and implementation. Let's see what else we got here. So a few other thing requirements. This is just sort of a heads up, because these things the statute was amended with these things since we've seen it last. One of the most important ones is going to be AB 1233. And essentially what AB 1233 says, if sites weren't made available or if there's an unaccommodated need, then that unaccommodated need must be rezoned for within the first year of the planning period. Okay, that's not from first year of adoption, that's the first year of planning period. And so in other words, if you said you'd rezone last time or you just failed to plan, never got a plan together, then there needs to be an analysis of whether sites were made available. If there was an unaccommodated need, that must be zoned for in the first year planning period. That is in addition to your regional housing need allocation. Okay, it's on top of. Doesn't go away at the end of the planning period. And once that, something to very much be aware of, and we recently amended our memo and sent it to every planning director in the state, is that if there's an unaccommodated need that must be zoned for in the first year of the planning period and it's not done after the year, we can't find you in compliance. You know, the statute won't let us find you in compliance until that zoning's done. So again, more emphasis on the importance of implementation, but also to be aware of. Some other, just real quickly, changes, AB 2634, the statute recognizes that while we have the very low and low income groups, extremely low, which is 0 to 30% of area median income, also has a unique need. In other words, someone making 30% of, what did she say the median income was, 60,000 earlier? 30% of 60 is much different than 80%. And even within that 0 to 30%, you could have very unique needs, from special needs, from people on public assistance to people making minimum wage. But it's important to recognize that this is a unique income group in terms of analysis of their existing needs, as well as identifying their projected need. However, as far as the density proxy and accommodating needs, it doesn't really enter the adequate sites requirement. The adequate sites requirement is for lower, meaning 0 to 80%. But there must be programs in place to assist in development. So these are things like, maybe prioritizing financing, maybe providing incentives, maybe establishing zoning for housing types that can accommodate the need, and so forth. So that's the AB 2634. And then the last major amendment to housing element law is SB2. And we have a memo on and guidance on each one of these. So keep that in mind, and I'll show us our website later. SB2, it has two pieces, separate pieces. One is the emergency shelters. Now, the zone must be identified to permit emergency shelters without a CUP or conditional use permit or other discretionary action. And there must be sufficient capacity to accommodate the need for emergency shelters. The second piece is transitional and supportive. The statute clearly states that transitional and supportive, as long as it meets the statutory definitions, are a residential use. They should be treated just like whatever proposed residential use they are. So in other words, if the transitional is single family and is proposing a single family zone, it should be treated like single family. Same as multifamily in a multifamily zone, it should be treated like its proposed residential use. And then finally, we've been working hard to prepare resources or websites and so forth to assist local governments as much as possible in preparing housing elements and updating things in-house. And one of the big things that we've done is to establish the building blocks for effective housing elements. And this website essentially lays out the different requirements of housing element law. It's kind of neat the way it's organized, because the housing element law is, you know, you can get lost in it if you're not familiar with it. And this really breaks it down to a very abstract level in terms of housing needs, in terms of resources, just like Mike broke it down earlier. And then it nests things within that in terms of their requirements, in terms of sample analyses, as well as helpful links. So on this website, you know, we've also laid out a couple full elements that can be picked up and used, or sample analyses that can actually pick up and use and apply it in terms of your local circumstances. Another thing that we will be doing, just like we did last time, we'll do some regional workshops. So we'll come down here and we'll spend the full day with you, maybe 2 days if you're lucky, and we'll go through these requirements and really, you know, to help you understand them and to help you with your updates. But also, one thing that we did last time was I was the regional representative, and that we thought was fantastic. Very helpful. It gave SANDAG member jurisdictions one point of contact. And there's also a lot of efficiencies in terms of understanding the region and as far as the reviews. So I can know what other jurisdictions were doing to help other jurisdictions. Or I could understand the relationships between, you know, North County, the Outback, and so forth. When I first got here, Mike gave me the history of the region. Was fantastic and really it helped us help you. And so we're gonna do that again. And I'll be at least the primary point of contact and continue to be engaged in the region at the least. But another thing that we did last time is we held office hours. And I don't know, Susan, what do you think about half took advantage of it, roughly? Less than half, huh? But the idea of the office hours is that HCD, during your update process, will come down here, set up time just to meet with you one-on-one and to talk about the things that you're looking at, talking about data sources, or maybe even to provide an agenda ahead of time to say, here's the things I'm looking at. But the idea was to come down, to meet with jurisdictions, and to provide assistance. And we're wide open to do that again this time. We thought, even though a lot of folks didn't come, maybe more will come this time. But we want to sit down and work with you through these processes, and we're committing to do that again. Other than that, demographic data resources, and that's all I got for you.
Take a couple questions for Paul.
Yes, sir.
How many more questions should I let this guy?
Paul, on some of the timing issues for some cities, because of unknown circumstances, that can be difficult. An example of Carlsbad with their housing element being sued, and it's a CEQA lawsuit over it. I think as communities start pushing back, we're going to see more of that, and it's going to be very difficult doing housing elements with DIRs, but we're doing density increases. Mm-hmm. The other thing that cities have to deal with that are on the coast is the Coastal Commission, and because of their staffing levels, any type of LCP is now taking over a year to get an amendment to. And when you're doing a comprehensive general plan, you can probably anticipate a couple years with them. Even though a city's approved it, it technically we can't implement it until the Coastal Commission approves it. Have you guys given any consideration to that, those kind of circumstances in relationship to the timing?
We are on the environmental review front. It is a tough one when you're going through comprehensive general plan updates. There's a lot of uncertainties and so forth, as well as the environmental reviews, and those can take time. But as far as the statute, you know, this isn't a number that we're making up. This is something that's in the statute. We're bound by it. It says 120 days, you know. So while we can sit here and put our heads together about how we can help you, it's not going to change what that deadline. Port Wyoming, that's Ventura County.
Yeah, but I was going to mention regarding how we were able to work with HCD on the Coastal Commission. The key property for meeting the arena for that city is already zoned properly with general plan, but it hasn't really, the rezoning hasn't been approved by the Coastal Commission. But that process, I think HCD understood that, and we were able to utilize that site without the Coastal Commission's process.
You're talking LCPs because of the comprehensive general plan update, or because of doing rezoning and so forth?
I'm talking more of the rezoning. The general plan is not at the right zoning, so we'd have to amend everything.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
It's a little tougher, but it's, you know, each area is different too. And Port Wyoming, in terms of their LCP, the policy and whatever, was.
That's true.
We're able to put our heads together and think about it and try to come up with a solution.
You know, it's interesting listening to these conversations because, in essence, sometimes I think the HCD staff fall into the bad guy category. But if you stop and think about what their role and responsibility is, it's to make sure your housing element complies with the state law, and you want your housing element to comply with the state law, and they're trying to help you get there. And it's something to keep in mind as you deal with this process.